So now we're going to have an exercise of meditation, guided meditation, through the four different slices of awareness that Dr. Siegel explains with his circle of awareness. And it basically touches on developing the awareness that we can awaken within the information that we get. So when we focus on something, we're placing awareness on something, and we'll be then, as we sit comfortable today, and you close your eyes, and you breathe in and out, then you'll be able to bring your attention to the first slice of the circle of awareness, which is our five senses. And we can become aware that our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, and our touching are great source of information to become aware of a lot of the things out there. As we identify the magnitude of this slice, and we are grateful for it, we can now move into the second slice, which is this interception, is this ability to look inwards and feel our own organs and muscles and emotions, to feel our hunger and thirst, and a lot of important information for ourselves that's coming through this awareness, through introspection. Now we can move to the third slice, which allows us to bring our neocortex brain into our awareness and understand and bring in memories from our childhood, projects for our future, where we can also become focused on our thoughts and our values. An important thing that defines us, as we appreciate the importance of this third slice, we can now move to the last slice, which is about the world outside and how we can move into relationships and how we can move into other aspects of socializing, social norms, and being able to develop relationships and our connection to the planet, being able to be aware of the needs and expectations from others. And as we close this final slice, we can realize that awareness is something that we can use a lot more, that the more we are conscious of it, we can start changing our behaviors and our feelings and improve our skills in communication and in empathy. So enjoy that awareness for a few more seconds as we go to the next stage.
Coming back around, in late June, Jorge and I were standing back in the kitchen area there having coffee, and they were asking for people to sign up for presentations. So we had been talking about the relationship between what's being learned about our behavior, our neurology, and our relationships. And in our brief discussion, we just sort of brainstormed and said, why don't we do a presentation? So all that was great and wonderful, but a couple days after that, I left the area. I was gone, which left Jorge here doing all the nuts and bolts and all the work to try to put this together, which was really unfair, and I really appreciate it. And so with that, this is rather spontaneous to a certain extent today, but hopefully it will all tie together and make sense. And I want to start this by saying, on the trip I was on, I was in Arizona and at a museum, I picked up this fossil. This is about 65 million years old, of an ammonite, which was a sea creature that, kind of like a nautilus, it kind of went along in the ocean. It had a head and tentacles and all that. And this creature, as it lived its life, and it's a beautiful, and I'm going to lay this down up here. You can come and look at it if you want when we're done. But the symmetry, the organization of this creature is wonderful. And this creature was totally integrated with itself. Its life and its existence, it without thinking about it, it was integrated. Its whole being was working in harmony with every other part of its being and in relationship to its external world. But it had a very simple neurology. And 65 million years later, here we are, and our neurology is very much more complex. And that's both a blessing and it can also be a curse. Because with our neocortex, or as we learn about the world, we can get pulled in many different directions by many different things, and it can leave us feeling out of harmony with ourselves. And so a psychiatrist who graduated from Harvard named Daniel Siegel has been researching how to reestablish harmony, both internally and in relationship with each other, in our relationships, and with the external world. And he's come up with many exercises and ways of doing that. And Jorge's been studying that for some time. I had not been. So my introduction to Daniel Siegel came via Jorge when we were having some of the few discussions we had about what to do today. So basically, I'm not going to say a lot today, except to stress just how wonderful it is at this period of time, even though looking at the world in a lot of areas you can't tell it, but how wonderful it is today that so much knowledge about what we can do as individuals to become more whole and have greater harmony within ourselves and with others around us is coming into existence. And Daniel Siegel is one of the people out on the cutting edge of that with his observations and presentations. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jorge.
Why don't we stay here and we... Okay, good. Excellent. Okay, so yes, I've been captivated by this author who has done, again, so much materials. He's very generous with everything he's creating, and then if you just go into YouTube or TED Talks or any of those, especially if you go to Amazon, you'll find all of his books, and I put them in Kindle and share them in all my devices. So it's really easy to get informed about this. He's actually creating something. He says that due to the situation with the world right now and the humanity, that it looks like we need to evolve again into a bigger, let's say, brain. And he's thinking that, well, he has a really handy model of the brain. So I guess most of you have seen a brain. It looks like this when you cut it in half. So the eyes would be right there. And this, I don't know if you're able to see this, but it brings the three main brains that we have. So the first one would be the first one in evolution, the neocortex, I mean, sorry, the reptilian brain. So there's this part is here, and then we have the mammalian brain, which is another added portion through evolution. And finally, we come up to the really thick neocortex brain, where we have this human, let's say, conduct and skills. So the handy model of the brain, let me pull this out, it's actually your hand. So as we have this, really, this is the picture, but this is the model. And we can see if this is like this, my eyes would be facing like this, behind this. As we have that hand closed, we'll see that this is the normal position of the brain. But when we open the model, we see then the reptilian brain right here with the brainstem and the whole spine. And then we can see that as we put this out, of course, this reptilian brain is really important to help us in many, many situations about our homeostasis and body temperature and a bunch of other things. So it's really busy with our unconscious world. And then we have this, let's say, mammalian brain, which is about 200 years old in evolution, and it has the limbic system. So this limbic system has actually a really important gland that's called the amygdala. And this brain now is a lot more able to express emotions, as we can see in many examples of mammalian animals, species. So the main function of this amygdala is actually to somehow take ownership of a specific situation that would be dangerous, and then the brain would take it with a response that we have all heard, which is the fight, flight, or freeze response. He added another F for faint. So any of those actions can happen basically with our automatic pilot, where we don't have to. And even if we're thinking about stopping something and this signal is really strong, this amygdala will hijack our normal responses and bring a reaction that oftentimes is not the most adequate. So this mammalian brain is really good, and it's already, for instance, for children that are born, they have this portion of their brain working perfectly well. Not that this is wrong, but the neocortex brain, which is the final portion of the brain, actually we fold it like this, shows the right brain and the left brain, and then the neocortex brain, the prefrontal lobe. And that prefrontal lobe is actually very close to create fibers with the limbic system and with the reptilian brain. And this then allows us to be able to do a lot about self-regulation. So we can, through our intention and our values and our things that we develop in our outside brain, in the third brain, then we can develop, let's say, the habit of being able to, let's say, change that flight and fight response that seems to be so powerful and to make it work better for us. So this is a really important part of the brain, the one that makes us human, and we need to learn more about it, I guess. Dr. Siegel says that this can be explained, this simple model can be explained to children. So we tend to understand a lot of other organs fairly well, our stomach, our guts, even our genitalia, we understand those because maybe they might be a lot simple, but at the same time, it's just like, okay, we can see that if I eat something, then all of this is gonna happen. But with our brain, we're not so, let's say, we're not so involved. And I think that then we talk about mental health and mental illness, according to Dr. Siegel again, with the wrong approach. It's like mental health is the absence of mental illness, I'm asking. So if you don't have one of those labels of having a mental issue, then are you mentally healthy? And it's not really the case. It's like you might not be diagnosed with, I don't know, bipolar disorder or so many of them, but you can still have a lot of issues about your self-esteem or about depression or about not being able to have a bunch of other things that will imply mental health, no? Having much more effectiveness in your relationships and in your free time and adding values to your mix. So mental health is a lot more complex than the absence of mental illness and of great consequences. So one of the things is the definition of defining the brain is fairly simple. It's an organ. It's actually a social organ that is connected through nerves and has a lot of different elements to it, really complicated. But then we think about the mind and what's the mind? When we think about mental health and all that, what is the mind supposed to be? Who can try to attempt defining the mind? For many years, it has been known as the mind is what the brain does. So it's like the brain is the hardware and the mind is the software. And that seems to work pretty well. But then they somehow defined, even doctors, starting with Hippocrates or something like that, he started by saying, well, the mind is brain activity. It's what the brain does. But then Dr. Siegel talks about the need to expand that really limited definition, because the mind is a lot more. It actually might be even outside the brain. The mind is something, he says, that it's a lot of processes of self-regulation and understanding and that implies transfer of data and information. Information and energy. So the flow of information and energy is what creates our brain. Yes. Yes, please, go ahead.
I want to interject something there in talking about that. The mind is not the brain. The mind is a separate thing. Mm-hmm. The brain is a tool, an organ that houses, maybe we can use the word houses the mind, but the brain isn't the mind. And one of the dramatic things that turned up in the past couple decades about this that just was very amazing to me, a physicist in Los Angeles named Siegfried Othmer relayed the information that I believe it was at UCLA they were doing experiments with reactions. And so, you know, our brain reacts, our nervous system. Say we touch a hot stove, the nerve impulse goes up, our brain registers it, the nerve impulse goes down, and we move our hand, right? No. This is the amazing thing that has turned up in the past few years, that when we find ourselves in a position of danger or threat of that nature that's extreme, that everything happens faster than our nervous system can process it. So there's something else at work. There is a system behind the system that has overriding control of our physiological systems. So, kind of woo-woo, but maybe. but we know that to be a fact. And so whether we call that the spirit, whether we call that the mind, I think nowadays Dr. Siegel and other people are starting to refer to that as the mind, and that the mind is all-encompassing. And the brain is an organ which does some of the processing of some of the nuts and bolts of our lives and contains a lot of information, but it is not our mind. So,
thank you. Actually, I don't recall the exact words for his definition, but he says that the mind is this series of processes where there's energy and information, flow of energy and information. And there's a lot of that flow of energy and information within us that's actually chemical, electrochemical in the case of the brain, and it might be physical in many other ways. But when we go beyond our within, then actually the mind is between us. He says this flow of energy and information happens within and between us. And then our communications are a flow. Our relationships are a flow of energy and information. You see, there's no energy there. There was a flow of something, but the information was there, but there was no energy with that. So when I start doing something that has no sense, then I might be talking in, I don't know, if I just say words that have no sense, then there'll be data, but it would be not intelligent type of thing. No? Anyways, it's not going to be intelligent in any other way, but I think that it's important that flow of energy and information would be seen even from the physicist perspective of things, where we can see that the light has photons and that photons hit the retina and then we can see things. And of course, when we hear any type of things that we move can bring this flow of energy and information. And that flow of energy information can be healthy or unhealthy, let's say. So in the case of having it healthy, how does that look? How does it look? And then parenting comes as a very important aspect, because it's through parenting that we can help children that have this, let's say, he calls this the downstairs brain and the upstairs brain. And the downstairs brain is, again, the mammalian and the reptilian brain together. And they are the ones that will be very clear and very, well, evident in children, for instance, having a tantrum or having any type of reaction where they don't know really what are the social issues and the knowledge and the common sense that we have through our neocortex brain. So we can see that the parenting effort should be in trying to bring things from the downstairs brain into the upstairs brain, and moving also things from between the left brain to the right brain, and a lot of things into the prefrontal cortex, and he calls that integration. So integration is the connection of different parts of the brain that will be done effectively through linkage, but then also pruning. So he talks about the huge difference between the brain of a child and an adolescent. The brain of a child has been creating those integrations for a few years, and he believes in Santa Claus, and he believes in the fairy, and he believes in a bunch of things, and he's just amazed with his parents. He thinks that Superman, and then he starts getting into this adolescence, and the adolescence is actually a change in the brain. It's really happening that, let's say, mess of nerves will now start to prune themselves into the most important aspects of themselves. So they will start to reinforce, and then myelin, which is a cover for the neurons, will start making, instead of just connections, they'll start making, let's say, highways of information between the different things. So adolescence is this portion where they want to create some independence, where they have to prune all these connections that are not really good for them, and try to come with a new structure that it's not evident anatomically, but it's certainly there with new connections. And that makes that every brain of us is so different in every single aspect. And that also the plasticity of the brain allows that these connections can be built pretty much at any age. So of course, starting early, for instance, when a child starts with his teenage years, he mentions that having them, let's say, get passionate about an instrument or about singing or about any type of things, even sports, that can allow them to develop all these skilled connections that can make such a difference in playing the piano or the violin or singing. And then if that student has not only attempting to play the guitar by himself, but has a teacher and learns about all these aspects about music, then his brain is going to be having a lot more resources into finding harmony in the world, and maybe having a lot more skills about communicating and social skills, just because he pruned his brain in a certain way. No? So this integration that that Dr. Siegel says it's actually the healthy thing to do with our brain is to develop more integration. And those integrations should be based in a way where, for instance, in parenting, again, trying to help our children to see in a specific situation that seems to be chaotic, it's actually the opportunity to start sharing some of the tools that they need to develop through building even more attachment with our children. So there was another idea, and I sort of forgot. The brain and the right and the left hemisphere of the brain is also really important to understand. He or somebody was explaining that the animals in the mammalian, mammals have these two hemispheres as well. And that the right brain of deer, let's say, is more to check on the outside and to make the connection, this reading about danger or not danger, about friends or foes, about really being able to decide what he's going to do in base of his interaction with the world. And the left brain was more about finding food and comfort and shelter. And those fibers then were specialized in logic and in reasoning and in language. So on the left side, on the left hemisphere, we have language, for instance. But in the and that will be words. And on the right brain, we have more this nonverbal type of cues that even a child can actually read very well. And maybe animals can do that much better than we can do. You have something to add?
I want to comment something that may help clarify how important integration is between these two hemispheres of the brain. There is a condition where fetal alcohol syndrome, where a mother has consumed alcohol at certain times anyway. One of the manifestations of that is that often the child, the bundle of nerves that runs from the left hemisphere to the right hemisphere is called the corpus callosum, the main bundle of nerves. In a person affected with fetal alcohol syndrome, that may not be there. It may be very diminished, or it may not be there at all, which means the person does not have this ongoing robust connection between the right and left hemispheres of their brain. And how that manifests with behavior, and it's fascinating when you see this. You'll see a child who has done something, like stolen a car. And so you talk to the child, and the parents talk to the child and tell the child, you shouldn't do that, you know, and the child is truly feeling bad. And the child is saying, yes, I will not do that anymore. I really, and I love you guys, and I'm not going to steal cars anymore. Okay, so the love part, I really love you guys, and all that's coming from the right hemisphere of the brain. The part about, okay, I understand I should not steal cars, that's registering in the left hemisphere of the brain. But the two aren't connecting. So a month down the road, even though the love is the same, the child still loves their parents, that doesn't want to do anything, over here doesn't really want to hurt their parents. Over here, maybe the neurons shift and there's a new thought. Oh, I like that car, I think I'll steal that car. And so they do. And there's no consistency, there's no integration within their person between what's happening between the right and left hemispheres of their brain or in their behavior. So that's just one example of how what happens when the integration breaks down. And I think by understanding how that can happen, it helps us understand the importance of the integration.
Thank you. Yeah, perfect. That also gives me time to think about a couple of additional comments. Thank you. Okay, so also important is what we do to build integration in ourselves or in our children. And when we interact with, a child that's having some type of tantrum, somehow he's doing the best he can with the brain he has. And if his brain has not been developed, this upstairs brain, then he will always be lacking a better brain to do this. No, and brain development is not something that you inherit. It's something that you work and you shape along your life with different experiences. So if the experiences are the right ones, of course, you can be able to be much more effective in building things. But having bad experiences can also be a way to actually strengthen our integration, especially when we make those implicit memories, we make them explicit. So if a child, for instance, had a really bad experience at school, and that will be there maybe for the rest of his life in a subconscious way where it starts to modify his behavior and his personality, he can actually bring that still somehow fresh memory into the more external memory, the explicit memory, where he can share that experience with somebody else, like a parent, who can help him see the good and the bad from that experience, that can help get him prepared for the next situation where something like that happens, where you can start building, let's say, the neocortex brain and bring values and discuss principles and just always be mentoring, let's say, that effective communication, as opposed to say, don't cry, and stay over there, and don't come here. And those imperatives that are so common with our own children and that are not really helping in developing his upstairs brain. So there's one book that I strongly recommend, especially for parents, that says 12 effective techniques to integrate your children's brain. And the first one of all is called Connect and Redirect. So when we are in a specific situation, let's say some type of argument or a conflict with somebody else, it might be whatever age, the first thing that we need to do is bring our social brain into place by using our right hemisphere and connecting with his right hemisphere. So if a child was making a tantrum and broke something that was valuable, instead of saying, hey, you broke that and it's going to cost $100, or you're going to have to pay that for you, whatever comes from our, let's say, reactions, not responses, our reactions, then might not be the most effective way to approach a situation like this and to help that child build his upstairs brain. What he recommends is connect with the right brain with right brain, which means, oh, it looks like you are really angry about something, which means you acknowledge the emotion that you see. And by doing that, a lot of things can happen. The person that's actually having that thing gets recognized with an emotion that he's actually trying to show. And then he will most likely say, yes, I'm angry. And as a salesperson, the more yeses that you get into a conversation, the more likely that you'll have a better, let's say, connection with that person. And it's a technique that salespeople use a lot. They drive you through a few yeses. They know the answer already. They're not interested in knowing the answer for that, but they are building you some type of rapport and making you most likely say another yes at the next question. So if we connect with the right brain, it can take just a couple of sentences maybe, then the child will feel like, okay, he can trust somebody, he feels the, let's say, the support of somebody telling him that he's angry, and then probably the next question would be, what would you like to do about that right now? No, just having the explanation of that little boy having to develop the skills to express himself can build a lot of that integration. And then compare, let's say, there's a lot of techniques, like, for instance, you can build what if, or just start asking questions. What is the positive, the negative, how would that be into a plan? Just have his brain have some exercises, more than just the discipline of saying, you go away because you're punished and you have to pay for that as you grow up. We can start being much more empathic as we bring that connection with the right brain. And then that relationship and the situation will be very easy to shift to the left hemisphere, where we can say, well, that really is an expensive loss because I was hoping that we can use this for that and something. We'll have to find a way to repair this. And that comes with, again, creating responsibility, but mostly the empathy. So he's really pushing through a project that he is called Wisdom 2.0. If you check on that in Google, you'll find that he's trying to create a lot more consciousness in humanity about the importance of empathy and communication and integration as a way to move away from this perspective of having to fight and having to be always against the other ones, and you have to defend yourself and you have to be always opposing things, and just allow these connections to happen. And he says these connections is not like a, it's not like a telephone, central telephone where all these cables are going in and out. It's more like an orchestra where all the musicians are synchronized and are in harmony to bring the movement, let's say, of those connections and have the brain working, not only interconnected, but with a lot of harmony. So how do we, again, how important it is to start learning more about the brain and talking about the brain? I think that it's very important because mental health, we cannot wait for the mental health let's say, experts, which mostly place labels on people and then give some medication based on whatever they diagnose. But they don't have any time to build these skills among us. And then having this effort done with no, let's say, doctors is very feasible, just by knowing that our integration is something that we can help us actually change our brain to change our mind. You know? So the mind is more powerful than the brain. The mind can actually reduce the type of medications that somebody can get, or can just build your skills so much more when you start using your time in a way that you can integrate your brain, most of it. Thank you.
And stepping in, a lot of that, talking about the brain and the right brain, the left brain, all that, we're talking about internal integration within a person, how we become integrated with ourself, with our emotions, our thoughts, our behaviors. There's also within the circles that Dr. Siegel draws is the outgoing step of becoming integrated with others, with the world around us. And a couple of things that really stress the importance of this are they have found that there are portions of our brain, of our neurology, that's what they're dedicated to. That we are social, we are inescapably social beings. And our interconnections are reflected internally in each one of us within our neurology, within our brain, within our mind. But we also know we see the phenomena of, it's somewhat similar. Einstein called this kind of strange behavior at a distance, something like that, where a molecule is spinning over here, but it's got some relationship to a molecule over there 10,000 miles away. When this molecule changes its spin, that molecule will change its spin simultaneously. There's a connection there. No one can see it. No one knows where it comes from, but it's there. It's undeniably real. And we know more now that that is also true between us as human beings, that we are undeniably connected. What affects one of us, we are, in a way, you might say that the human race is a larger organic system of its own upon the earth. That maybe, in a way, we're all individual cells of this larger organic system, which is the human race, and that we either stand together or we fall together. And these are some of the new realizations that are coming out of the study of both spiritualism and psychology, psychiatry, neurology, that are really fascinating, that these are no longer like back in Emerson's day when he could say, you know, we're all connected, and everyone go, oh, yeah, we're all connected. You know, now I'm going to set up my business over here, and I'm going to make as much profit as I can from the rest of you because I'm the one who matters. That's one example of where connection breaks down. That within this connection, what can be a healthy connection? What is a healthy society? And they're starting to find ways of defining that. And so the work that Daniel Siegel is doing in his, what he calls integration, trying to bring this all together into a meaningful whole, that's scientifically grounded, that we can all rely upon as being accurate, whether or not, you know, it's something he's not going to achieve by himself, but he's bringing lots and lots of people together to work on this idea from many different disciplines. And it's gradually growing. So like Jorge mentioned, I really encourage you to look up some of the videos and things online about what they're finding out through this field of study, because it's truly exciting, and I think it's very optimistic when we start to realize that we all matter, and that you matter to me, and that I matter to you, that what happens to one of us is going to affect all of us. It may be small, but accumulatively, a lot of small effects become a big effect. And so it is important. And one of the things that Jorge mentioned that is critical to the whole process is the concept of values. Because as he was saying, our mind is more powerful than our brain. We might have had it drummed into us over and over and over and over and over again in school that such and such thing is important. And that may be have these what are called engrams, these places where it's programmed into our hardware, our neurology, that's important. Maybe it is and maybe it isn't. The thing is, our mind can override that. We can change. We aren't locked into the state that we're in at any one given moment. We all can progress. We all can develop. We all can change in ways that previously thought were impossible. Cognitively, we can change our DNA. Now, 10 years ago, they would have said maybe the primary thought would have been, that's impossible. You can't change your DNA with your thoughts. But yes, you can, and it's proven. And it's been known for some time that through repetitive behaviors, because thoughts are reflected in our behaviors, we actually, through a mechanism called messenger RNA, we can change our DNA. So not even DNA is a life sentence. We are far more flexible and plastic than we have ever imagined in our past. And we are producing new brain cells all the time. You used to say all the brain cells you had are the ones you're born with. When those are gone, they're gone. That's not true. We know that's not true. And it takes about, just interesting trivia, it takes about 2 weeks from the birth of a new neuron to when it becomes plugged in to where it's going to do whatever it's going to do in the brain. So quite often, 2 weeks might be a period of time that we could say, I want to change this behavior. It's going to take me maybe at least 2 weeks, because one of the things these new neurons do is open up new pathways for behavior. So even though our existing neurons can change connections, they're not written in stone either. They can move, our connections can move around, and they do move around. But we're also creating entire new neurons that come up and place themselves in our brain and allow us to do totally new things and experience new things. So that's, again, part of the whole optimistic excitement around this idea of integration, that we can become integrated not only with ourselves, with each other, with our communities, and with our world through all these varieties of disciplines, from environmental sciences to nutritional science to agriculture to industrial science. All those things can work together, not work separately and divisively as they have been doing in the past, to a way that complements the entirety of the human species and the earth itself.
Thank you very much, Ken. Yes. Okay, so then, yes, I have the conviction, let's say, that the best gift you can give to yourself and to your family and to your society is actually to work in your own integration that allows our brain to shape the way we want it. And I can notice that with myself somehow. Once I have a clear, let's say, objective, I can somehow build some integration about what I need to learn with how I need to practice and how I need to just connect a few things out there and being able to understand much more outside by just bringing your own, let's say, work and sharing it with others. So this might be a topic within the fellowship, because, of course, this touches a lot of the outside world, and even being able to discuss important topics in our community or in society would be a great way to use this.